what's happening in Africa.
There's no doubt that this is a nightmare for the young children, these girls that have been abducted.
A global outcry against the Nigerian kidnappings. Going dry in Yemen and Somalia. The forgotten need in Mali. And refugees. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. The kidnapping of 276 schoolgirls in Nigeria has put the world on notice. It's time to pay attention to what's happening in Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. Boko Haram militants, who want an Islamist state, stormed a secondary school in a small Nigerian village in April and kidnapped 276 girls. Some escaped, but 8 more were taken a couple of weeks later, held as their captors offered to exchange them for prisoners. Those abductions could deter parents from sending their daughters to school, a senior official for the UN's Children Fund told UN Radio. Dr. Nicholas Alapui said the group's threat to sell or forcibly marry the girls is a credible threat that should not be taken lightly. Jocelyn Sambira spoke with Dr. Alapui at the UN.
What are some of the lessons that UNICEF has learned that it can share with Nigeria in terms of how to protect these children while they're at school?
Before coming to this interview, I was looking at the numbers of schools that have been attacked, the numbers of children that have been abducted. This is not the first time this sort of thing is happening. The very first big problem is the problem of denial and the fact that there is some expectation, naively or otherwise, that by closing an eye to the problem, it would go away. I think the first thing that needs to be understood that it is absolutely critical that we acknowledge that there is a problem and that we are able to track the numbers of attacks on schools, the numbers of children that are being abducted, and to make their voices audible, amplify their voices, and give them a chance to be returned to their families. I think that for UNICEF, what we have learned is that it is critical that we mobilize at all levels, both the political leadership, local leadership, civil society organizations, and make this case a concern for everybody. Every child that goes through this sort of experience is one too many. It is not just the suffering of the individual child, it is also the loss to the community and to their families, and a loss to the state, the nation, and the country of Nigeria and its people lose quite a lot because of the abduction of these children.
Do you think that it will deter some families from sending their girls to school?
Absolutely. The threats that we are hearing are enough to scare anybody. And because the perpetrators have claimed responsibility and have acknowledged that they, in fact, are willing to hurt these children, sell them off or marry them off, is a credible threat. And I think it is, in fact, something we should not underestimate. We should take all the resources, make all the resources available to the government, both internationally and domestically, to respond to this threat. So it's not something to underestimate. We better, in fact, want to repeat our call to the perpetrators to release these children unharmed to their families without further delay.
Dr. Nicholas Alapui is with the UN's Children Fund. Terrorism and religious extremism are challenges in many countries, but nature poses challenges too. The 10 most water-stressed countries in the world are all in the Middle East or North Africa. Yemen, perhaps best known in the U.S. as the target of covert drone strikes, is in an especially dire position. War News Radio's Amy DiPiero asks whether water, as much as terror, is a security threat to the world.
Yemen is in a crisis. But it's not a crisis caused by extremist training grounds, nor by radical Islamic clerics, nor by U.S. drone strikes.
Some hydrologists predict that many wells in Yemen will run dry in as little as 10 years.
Hillary Rodham Clinton speaking on World Water Day.
Water resources could be targeted by terrorists or manipulated as a political tool. These difficulties will all increase the risk of instability within and between states. So these threats are real, and they do raise serious security concerns.
As of 2011, Yemen is the seventh most water-stressed country in the world. It is home to a growing population and a shrinking water supply. Internal problems, most of all widespread poverty, political uncertainty following the resignation of President Ali Abdullah Saleh in 2012, and economic dependence on water-intensive crops frustrate efforts to manage water resources. The most immediate consequence for nearly half of the population is the inability to produce or purchase the food they need. Clinton and others consider Yemen's water crisis to be a security threat to the region and to the United States. But beneath this strategic danger, lack of water in Yemen is a local humanitarian challenge. Then again, it's easy to overlook a problem that lies under the surface, in the groundwater.
If you would only have rivers, yeah, and you would use all your water from your rivers, the river runs dry.
Frank van Steenbergen is water resources director at MetaMeta, a private research and development firm based in the Netherlands. He's worked on political and technical water issues in Yemen for the past 15 years.
But if you have groundwater, it's like you have a huge bank account, which is built up over many years. But you can use much more annually than you put back into your account.
Hydrologists call this process, putting money back into the bank account, recharge. Since the 1970s, when the government subsidized diesel and offered other incentives for farmers to grow food for exports, new irrigation techniques have depleted groundwater without giving it a chance to recharge fully. Experts estimate that up to 90% of Yemen's water goes to farming. Not food staples, but water-intensive crops like grapes and khat, a popular, mild, and highly profitable narcotic that van Steenbergen compares to coffee. Because building an irrigation system or a well is so expensive, in the 70s, groundwater was often controlled by the wealthy and powerful. There are now about 100,000 wells in Yemen, but Yemen's former Minister of Agriculture, Nasser al-Awlaki, says inequality persists.
We have an equity problem. The poor is paying a lot of money for water, and if they want to get water, they have to buy it from the rich people who own the wells.
Even in the north, where khat is usually grown and strong tribal affiliations translate into better access to water, the resource can be so scarce that disputes over water rights lead to violence.
When water resources are scarce, this can also create local conflicts or local competition for water.
Jessica Barry is the communications coordinator and spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Sana'a, Yemen.
There have been, over the last few years, a number of really very serious clashes and conflicts between different, not only local tribes, but between different political parties or different military parties. It has resulted in very large displacement of communities.
Down along the coasts, van Steenbergen says, already impoverished communities are forced to migrate because of water shortages. Leaving behind their farms and villages to live in cities, poverty, unemployment, and overcrowding follow them.
The people who were affected were poor people with a very little political standing, yeah, and often a very limited understanding of what was happening. So sad, but left their villages.
Where can you find a solution to water scarcity if the starting point is so complex? Mark Jansen manages the Federation of American Scientists International Science Partnership, a project in which scientists from the United States and Yemen collaborate to solve water and energy issues. He says he knows where not to start.
Ultimately, I'd say it's a little condescending to sort of conflate U.S. national security priorities, such as combating terrorism, with the human need for water.
The instinct in Washington, D.C., he says, is to put water on the national security agenda. That category would start a domino effect, mobilizing a bureaucracy of counterterror experts armed with security solutions. But making water a national security issue is a double-edged sword.
Securitizing the issue is one way to sort of focus the government's attention on a policy priority. But I would say that we should be very careful about breezily associating water security with the war on terror. Our ability to meet challenges with Yemenis in a shared fashion is really predicated in large part on the separation of that work from counterterrorism and other national security efforts the United States is involved in.
Unfortunately, the American government after the 1990s, they somehow really disappeared from the scene regarding the water issues in Yemen.
Al Awlaki, Yemen's former Minister of Agriculture.
After the Gulf War in 1991, they stopped completely their aid to Yemen. And then they came back again, but this time they came and they were much concerned about only security issues, giving government ammunition and logistical support to fight so-called terrorism.
This is exactly the concept of American aid in Yemen Janssen wants to change by having American and Yemeni scientists collaborate on issues other than counter-terror. Barry at the Red Cross agrees that it's crucial to work together, but Yemenis must take the lead in solving the humanitarian problem of water crisis with humanitarian solutions.
What is really important to keep in mind is that the communities are able to help themselves. Communities should be given the means to help themselves, and more importantly, they should be involved in the solutions to their own problems.
Von Steenbergen already sees evidence of Yemenis taking charge of their water. He says young farmer leaders are interested in combining new technology for irrigation with ancient patterns of conservation. He says tribes have developed a way to mediate local disputes, preventing feuds within communities by having members of neighboring tribes raise complaints in local courts. If these community plans are sustainable, he says, they could point to solutions for water shortages elsewhere.
We should fight those groundwater crises where they occur. They will be a big global problem. So if we know how to deal with it in the hotspots, we're doing the right thing.
Once, says Van Steenbergen, he asked a retired government official why scarce water went unaddressed by then-President Saleh. The official said one reason is that there are easier issues to face, like terrorism.
Because he says, A, you get a lot of money to work on it, and B, it's not a big problem.
Yemen, today, is in crisis. Or rather, it is trying to balance water and food crises with a terror threat that can seem easier to handle by comparison. For War News Radio, I'm Amy DePiro.
Coming up, the crisis zone that the world has forgotten. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1297. The arid zone in West Africa is a desperate place, with help needed for even the most basic necessities. But financial aid to the region has dried up. UN Radio has more.
People in West Africa's Sahel region are amongst the most vulnerable in the world, with crises in the region becoming more frequent and communities in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, says that a lack of funding from the international donor community is one of the reasons why aid isn't getting to the people who need it the most. Robert Piper, United Nations Assistant Secretary General and Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Sahel, says that Mali is in desperate need of assistance to secure the most basic of services such as education, health, electricity, and water, which are particularly lacking in the north of the country. He's appealing for donors to step up their aid.
Mali is perhaps the worst-funded humanitarian appeal in the region. It has the most acute humanitarian needs in terms of suffering, in terms of malnutrition, in terms of food insecurity in the northern parts of the country. It had the most successful donor conference on record in Brussels in May when donors put $1 billion more than had been requested on the table. And yet, it's the appeal that we launched for Mali is barely 42% funded, I believe. It's almost the worst in the region after Gambia. It's counterintuitive, but we're trying to figure out how to reverse that. But Mali certainly remains a huge concern.
Robert Piper, United Nations Assistant Secretary General and Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Sahel on Mali. I'm Jocelyn Sambura for UN Radio.
To the south, there's another drought emergency. The country of Somalia is already struggling with a lack of food. Combine that with no rain, inflation, and conflict, and there's a crisis. Daniel Dickinson has more from UN Radio.
A drought emergency in Somalia could aggravate the country's fragile food security situation unless immediate action is taken, according to the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for the Horn of Africa nation. In a press briefing in Geneva, Philippe Lazzarini said that a combination of delayed rains, rising food prices and continued conflict is further worsening the humanitarian situation in Somalia.
We start to have early warning of expected rain below average, which might impact severely the upcoming harvest. The problem is, the big difference compared to last year is we have twice less resources. We have about 50,000 children at the doorstep of death.
Mr. Lazzarini explained that some agencies and non-governmental organizations have so few resources that essential life-saving projects are facing closure. UN agencies and humanitarian partners appealed for $933 million in 2014, but have only received 15% of the funding so far. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Another issue is disease. Polio has reemerged in 10 countries: Afghanistan, Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Ethiopia, Iraq, Israel, Nigeria, Pakistan, Somalia, and Syria. Little wonder that those who can leave this troubled region do, but that creates its own challenges. Once a refugee family has been here for a while, the children often become the ambassadors to the outside world for their parents, who may take longer to adapt. It's the kids who have to translate for their parents and deal with all the bureaucracy of life, from hospitals to schools to immigration offices. Reporter Jessica Partnow has more from Washington State.
Birch Creek is a huge public housing complex in East Hill, a couple of miles from downtown Kent. Just over 1,000 people live here. The place was completely renovated in 2010, and the streets are Disneyland clean. More than half of the people who live here are immigrants and refugees from all over the world. There's a community center where a Polynesian dance troupe practices every week. 74% of the kids here live in homes where English is a second language. At 3:30 on school days, kids pour into the gym and the computer lab for a few quick games before being shuffled upstairs for homework help.
We, on any given day, we have students from Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya, Iran, Iraq.
Roslyn Kaji runs a tutoring program at Birch Creek.
Turkey, Moldova, Russia, the Ukraine, Mexico, Thailand, Vietnam.
Most of Roslyn's students are refugees or recent immigrants.
I remember a couple weeks ago we stopped and counted. We were going around the table talking about how to say hello in our language, and we realized that there was 11 different languages being spoken at one tutoring table.
A lot of Roslyn's job is helping kids and parents navigate new systems. For some families, the schools here are just a little different from the ones back home. It's like moving to a new state. For others, coming from conflict zones or some refugee camps, just having school every day is new.
So a lot of times the parents will come in and they don't quite know how to say it, but I can tell. I'm like, all right, cool. Their kid's here and they want them to study, so I'll make that happen for them.
Liz Peter came to Birch Creek for tutoring when she was in high school. Now she's 19, just finishing her second year of college. She lives an hour away in Shoreline, but she tries to come back every Tuesday and Thursday to help out. She recently tutored a boy from Puerto Rico.
He was asking me where I was from, and I was like, I'm from Sudan. He's like, oh yeah, that's in Africa. That's why Kenya. I was like, how do you know that? You're only like 8.
Liz was born in southern Sudan. Her family moved to a refugee camp in Kenya when she was a year old. They came to the U.S. as refugees the next year, in 1993. Today, a little knot of 10 and 12-year-old girls in headscarves is crowding around Liz as tutoring gets started.
I really do have homework, and I do need help.
You can come over here, and I can help you.
Liz seems like a natural, joking around about math homework with a fifth grader from Somalia.
I haven't done math by hand in such a long time.
Okay, then what's 6 times 5?
6 times 5 is 30.
Liz uses her iPhone to double-check the math.
So 38 times 45. How would you start doing that?
Wait for it.
Liz is fun to be around. She's happy and energetic. She's proud of her life. Watching her tutor, it's hard to believe that she almost didn't finish high school.
I was just tired of school. Same thing every day. And I felt like I wasn't that great at school. Like, I passed with C's and D's. And I was just not motivated at the time.
Liz says her parents weren't really paying attention.
Like, sometimes your parents don't have any educational background. And so, like, they don't know how to help you. Like, you can pass school with all D's and, like, they wouldn't know it.
She says it felt like they just wanted her to finish high school because that's what you're supposed to do. When they first came to the States, they went to Iowa, but they moved around for years looking for work. Eventually, they decided to join one of Liz's uncles in Seattle. Liz didn't like it.
I hated it. I hated being in Seattle. It's like it rains all the time and there wasn't any other kids around. It's like older people. So we couldn't really go outside and we walked a Safeway all the time for no reason.
For the first 6 months or so, they stayed in a one-bedroom apartment with Liz's uncle and 30 other people. This was early high school. Liz thinks it was that crowded apartment that finally pushed her to get serious about her education.
And so I wanted to get out the house, so I would always be at school, tutoring places, play sports, do anything to just stay at school. So I got really good grades.
Today, Liz lives in Shoreline with her mom and 7 younger brothers and sisters. They have a 5-bedroom house. It's public housing, so rent is just $50 a month, but they're struggling. Her mom is looking for a job, but it's hard because she doesn't speak English.
So basically my whole life I've watched my mom do like labor jobs, house cleaning, housekeeping, jobs like that.
They have a big family, and Liz thinks of her cousins almost like brothers and sisters.
Mama, you take a man down in it.
When Liz talks to her mom, she switches easily between English and Nuer. Nuer is the southern Sudanese language her family speaks.
My mom's dad had 3 wives. So between her, kati tika ga dan more dan di. 10? She had 10 siblings. My dad had around 10. My mom has 8 children.
Liz's mom grew up in a rural village. She didn't go to school. She never worked outside the home. Liz's life is completely different from what her mom's looked like at that age. For Liz's mom, this is a different world. Liz has to help her mom interpret a lot of everyday life. Rosalind Kaji says she sees this a lot. She's worked with refugee kids for several years and says there's just so much that new arrivals have to learn.
How do you find housing? What are all these crazy processed foods in a grocery store? How does the school system work?
Refugee kids navigating this new system straddle the world of school and the world of their parents.
A lot of our kids go to the school and they're all kind of the foreign refugee kids. And what's interesting is that most of them come from different countries, speak different languages, have a different culture, have a different language. Some of them were on opposite sides of a war, fighting for years, and now they come here and they're best friends and they're hanging out at the youth center together.
Tudor, come here.
Today, Liz is distracting her youngest sister while her mom loads the minivan with clothes for a trip to the laundromat. Liz's dad left 5 or 6 years ago to go back to Sudan. And ever since then, Liz has become almost like a parent to her younger siblings. She goes to their teacher conferences. Now that she's over 18, she doesn't even have to bring her mom. Liz is determined to be the first in her family to graduate from college. Now she just has to convince all 7 of her younger brothers and sisters that they can do it too.
Some of them are not looking so great right now, but I keep pushing them. I have to bribe them. I have to go to parent-teacher conferences. Just everything I can do just to try to help them, but sometimes it's not enough.
During her freshman year at Seattle Pacific University, Liz had a couple of her brothers come stay with her on campus for a night to start to get the feel of college. She has 2 more years to go herself, but she's already thinking about the next step. Liz has heard that if you speak English, it's easy to get a job in the newly independent nation of South Sudan. She can't remember anything about life there, but she loves the idea of going back. For KOW, I'm Jessica Partnow.
Jessica Partnow is a co-founder of the Common Language Project. Support for this series on refugees in the Seattle area comes from the Program Venture Fund. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear the show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. This week's show is number 1297. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.